Imagine dedicating an entire year of your life and, hundreds of thousands of dollars to growing thousands of acres of corn.
Oh man,
Your
yeah.
crop is perfect. It's sitting in these massive silos ready to hit the market. And then a single unexpected rainstorm half a world away causes global crop yields to surge, prices absolutely plummet, and overnight you are completely bankrupt.
Terrifying.
Yeah, that terrifying, very real scenario is exactly why the futures market was invented in the first place. Welcome to the deep dive. And real quick, this episode is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Absolutely, check them out.
So we have a very specific mission for this deep dive today. You, the listener, have your study materials, your notes, and this looming test date. So we are going to deconstruct the beast that is the Series 3 exam, but we are throwing out the dry, boring textbook tone because, let's be honest, standard lectures often just go in one ear and out the other.
Oh, complete.
Especially if you're like me and you have ADHD, you just zone out. So we need to actively understand how the actual plumbing of this financial system works.
That is exactly the right approach. Understanding the structure of your survival map, I like to call it, is the first critical step because you are facing two distinct battles on this
It's
exam.
two parts, right?
Right, so the first part is market knowledge. That covers chapters 1 through 7 of your typical study materials, and you need a 70% to pass that section. But then the second part is regulations. That is entirely contained within chapter 8, and it acts as a completely standalone pass or fail gate.
Wow.
I still need a 70% there. The brutal reality of this exam, and I've seen this happen, is that you can score a 95 on part 1, but if you get a 69 on part 2, you fail the entire exam.
Oh, that is so brutal. So, which means we cannot afford to just skim the legal and regulatory sections at the end when we're tired. But what strikes me about the strategy you shared with me before we started recording is that the secret to crushing this exam, it isn't rote memorization, right? It's not about flashcarding yourself into a coma.
No, it really isn't. If you try to just memorize rules and definitions, the exam writers, they will twist the phrasing of the question and they will trap you.
Yeah.
The key to the Series 3 is deeply understanding the mechanics of risk. Why does the futures market even exist? What specific problem is a hedger actually trying to solve? If you understand the fundamental why driving the market, you can logic your way out of almost any trick question they throw at you.
Even if you momentarily blank on a definite.
Exactly. Even if you forget the exact word, you can logic it out.
I love that. Logic over memorization. So, to do that effectively, we are going to ground all these abstract, kind of floaty financial concepts by using a recurring cast of characters today. Having a narrative makes these concepts sticky. So, I want you, the listener, to picture these people vividly as we go. First up, we have Farmer Fred.
Good old Fred.
Good old Farmer Fred. He is an anxious corn grower. He has actual physical corn sitting in his silos, and he is terrified, absolutely terrified that the price of corn is going to crash before he can sell it. Fred absolutely hates risk.
He wants nothing to do with it. And on the other side of that commercial equation, we have Baker Bob. Bob is this massive bread tycoon. He doesn't have wheat or corn today, but he absolutely needs massive quantities of it in 6 months to keep his factory lines running.
Right, to bake the bread.
Exactly. And Bob's nightmare is that a drought happens and the price of grain spikes before he can buy it. So like Fred, Bob hates risk. He's just looking at it from the exact opposite direction.
Okay, so Fred fears a price drop, Bob fears a price spike, and finally, we have speculator Sally.
Ah, Sally.
Sally is our adrenaline junkie. She doesn't own a farm, she doesn't own a bakery. She has absolutely zero commercial interest in physical corn or wheat. She just has a ton of capital. She loves leverage. And she wants to make a bet on which way the price is going to move. She thrives on the exact price risk that Fred and Bob are desperately trying to run away from.
Yes, so keep Fred, Bob, and Sally in your mind. They represent the entire ecosystem of the futures market. Basically, every trade, every rule, and every regulation we discuss today revolves around how these three specific people interact.
Okay, so how did this ecosystem actually start? Let's go back to the why. Because before futures contracts existed, people used forward contracts, right?
Right, yeah.
So let's say Farmer Fred makes a private, handshake deal to sell 100,000 bushels of his corn to Baker Bob next year at a set price. That's a forward
Yeah,
contract.
exactly.
It's private, it's totally customized to whatever Fred and Bob agree on over a beer. But if I'm thinking about this logically, that introduces a massive vulnerability.
Huge.
What if Baker Bob's bakery empire collapses in 6 months and he goes totally bankrupt?
Yeah.
Fred is ruined. He grew all this corn specifically for a buyer who can no longer write the check.
You hit on the exact fatal flaw of a forward contract, and it's called counterparty credit risk. A forward contract is entirely dependent on one specific partner's financial health.
Right.
If your partner defaults, you are left holding the bag. Furthermore, because the terms are completely custom, you know, maybe they agreed on a weird non-standard amount of corn
yeah.
to be delivered to a highly specific warehouse in some random town on a Tuesday.
Right, like 3:17 p.m.
Exactly. No third party is going to want to buy that contract off of Fred. It's totally illiquid. You can't trade it.
Because it's not standardized at all. So this is where the futures market comes in to fix the plumbing. It solves both the liquidity problem and that terrifying counterparty risk problem.
Precisely. So first, it solves the liquidity problem through strict standardization. A futures contract dictates the exact size. So say 5,000 bushels of corn, no more, no less. It dictates the exact approved grade of the commodity, the specific delivery month, and the specific approved delivery locations.
Because every single contract for December corn is exactly identical to every other December corn contract, they become completely fungible. A long position easily offsets any short position.
But wait, standardizing the contract, making it all uniform, that doesn't stop Bob from going bankrupt. So how do they solve the counterparty risk? Because if I buy a standardized contract from Farmer Fred on the exchange, yeah. am I still depending on Fred to stay solvent?
No, you are not. And this introduces a massive concept for the exam. Write this down. It's called novation.
Novation.
Novation. The moment a trade is executed in the trading pit or, you know, on the electronic matching engine, the clearinghouse steps squarely into the middle of the trade. The clearinghouse legally severs the tie between the original buyer and seller.
Whoa.
Yeah, through novation, the clearinghouse becomes the buyer to every single seller and the seller to every single buyer.
That is fascinating. So the moment the trade clears, Fred doesn't even know who holds the other side of his contract anymore. Like, it doesn't matter. Exactly. It doesn't matter at all. Fred is now legally bound only to the clearinghouse. And the buyer is bound only to the clearinghouse. Because the clearinghouse is backed by the massive collective capital of all its member firms, counterparty default risk essentially drops to zero.
Wow.
You never, ever have to worry if the guy on the other end of your trade is going to go bankrupt and ruin you.
That completely changes the game. It transforms a localized handshake into a global, trustworthy financial instrument. Okay, let's do a quick thought experiment for the listener to test this. I'm asking you, the listener, directly, so give it a second to think before we reveal the answer.
Yep.
If Farmer Fred sells a futures contract to protect his crop price, is he legally required to eventually load physical corn onto a truck and deliver it to an exchange warehouse when the contract expires?
Think about it.
The answer is no. He absolutely does not have to deliver the physical commodity. He can simply offset his position.
This is a crucial distinction that the exam will definitely test you on. The vast majority of futures positions, like often over 97% of them, are closed by offsetting, not by physical delivery.
Right.
Offsetting just means taking an equal and opposite trade in the exact same delivery month. So, if Fred sold one December corn contract to hedge his risk back in May, and now it's November and he wants out, he simply buys one December corn contract.
Okay.
The clearinghouse matches his short position with his new long position. They completely cancel each other out. His open interest drops to zero, and he is totally out of the market. He never has to touch a delivery truck.
That makes total sense, and it's so much easier. But wait, what if someone actually does want the physical commodity? Like, what if Baker Bob decides he really wants to take delivery for the wheat instead of offsetting? Who controls that process?
Okay. If physical delivery does happen, the exam desperately wants you to know who is in the driver's seat. It is always the short. The seller has the power.
The seller.
Yes. The short gets to choose whether to initiate delivery, when during the delivery month it will happen, what specific approved grade to deliver, because, you know, there are premiums and discounts for different grades, and which approved warehouse they will deliver it to.
Wait, why does the seller get all the power? Doesn't the buyer have a say? I mean, they're the one buying it.
Think about the logistics of it. Assembling, grading, loading, and transporting 5,000 bushels of physical commodity is incredibly difficult and resource intensive.
Yeah, that's true.
If the long, the buyer, could suddenly point at the calendar and demand delivery tomorrow in a specific city, the short would almost certainly fail to deliver. It would be impossible. The system would break down. So, to ensure the market functions smoothly, the heavy burden of logistics is placed on the seller. But in exchange, the seller is granted the flexibility to choose the time and place within the exchange's parameters.
Oh, that is a brilliant way to remember it. The one doing the heavy lifting gets to pick the time and place. So if you are holding a long position, say you're a speculator, Sally, and you live in a downtown penthouse apartment, and you do not want 5,000 bushels of physical corn dumped into your lobby, you had better offset your position before first notice day.
Precisely. First notice day is the first day the exchange allows shorts to issue delivery notices. If you are long and you hold past that day, you are essentially playing Russian roulette with a massive physical delivery.
That is a hilarious and terrifying image. Okay, let's pivot to the engine that actually allows the clearinghouse to guarantee all these trades. This brings us to exam trap alert number one.
Listen up for this one.
We need to talk about margin, because when I hear the word margin, you know, my mind immediately goes to the stock market.
And that is exactly what the exam writers are banking on. They want you to make that leap.
Yeah.
In the stock market, margin is a loan.
Right.
You want to buy $10,000 of stock, you put down $5,000 in cash, and your broker lends you the other $5,000. You own the stock, and you pay interest on that loan. Futures margin is a completely different animal, and confusing the two is a fatal error on the Series 3.
So if it's not a loan, what is it?
Futures margin is a performance bond. It is a good faith security deposit to prove to the clearinghouse that you have enough liquid capital to cover your daily losses. It is not a down payment on the commodity. It is not a loan. Because it is not a loan, there is absolutely no interest charged on futures margin.
Wow, okay.
Posting margin does not mean you own the corn or the gold. It just means you have skin in the game.
So it's essentially like a hotel holding my credit card for incidentals when I check in, just in case I trash the room. They aren't selling me the hotel room.
Yeah.
They just want a guaranteed deposit that proves I can pay for the mini bar I empty out.
That is a perfect analogy. I'm going to steal that. Now, we need to dive into the mechanics of how that deposit actually works, because there are two distinct levels you have to know. Initial margin and maintenance margin.
Okay.
Initial margin is the larger amount of money you must deposit to open the position in the first place. Let's say the exchange sets the initial margin for a corn contract at $5,000.
Okay, $5,000 to get in.
Right. Then, maintenance margin is a lower threshold that you have to maintain to keep that position open. Let's say the maintenance level is $3,000.
Okay, let me trace this out. I open the position with $5,000. The market moves against me a little bit, and my account drops to, let's say, $4,000. Am I in trouble? Do I get a call?
No. You are still safely above the $3,000 maintenance line. The exchange just lets it ride. But here is the trap. The market moves against you again. Your account drops to $2,900.
Oh.
You have now crossed the threshold. This immediately triggers a margin call.
Okay, so I'm $100 below maintenance. I just, you know, send the broker $100 on Venmo to get back to $3,000.
That is the exact trap the exam sets.
It is.
Yes. No, you do not just top it off to maintenance. If you fall below the maintenance margin level, you must restore the account equity all the way back up to the initial margin level.
Wait, really? So because I dropped to $2,900, I don't just owe $100. I have to send in $2,100 to fill the bucket all the way back up to the $5,000 initial margin.
Exactly. You fill the bucket all the way to the top.
Man.
The psychological and really systemic reason for this is that the exchange needs to see proof of your capital strength. If you are just scraping by, you know, just topping off to the bare minimum every day with $100 here and there, you are a systemic risk to the clearinghouse.
That makes total sense.
Forcing you to replenish all the way to initial margin proves you are solvent and serious. So remember that for the exam. Drop below maintenance, restore to initial.
Drop below maintenance, restore to initial. Got it. That is a massive distinction. All right, let's shift gears and look at the actual structure of these markets, because we hear the terms normal markets and inverted markets all the time. And honestly, when I first started looking at this, the terminology made my brain do flips. It's so confusing.
It is arguably the most tested conceptual trap in the entire first section, so we really have to make it intuitive. Let's start with a normal market. It is also referred to as a contango market, a premium market, or a carrying charge market.
Contango, premium, carrying charge. Got it.
A normal market is the default logical state for a commodity that you can store in a physical location over time, like corn, wheat, or crude oil. In a normal market, distant delivery months cost more than nearby delivery months.
Okay, let's break down why that is using Farmer Fred's silo. Say it's September and corn is trading at $5 a bushel for immediate delivery. But Baker Bob wants Fred to hold on to that corn and deliver it in December. Fred isn't going to just hold it for 3 months out of the goodness of his heart.
Exactly. He's not running a charity. Fred incurs costs to hold that corn.
Yeah.
He has to pay for the physical space in the silo. He has to pay insurance on the corn in case it, you know, rots or catches fire.
Yeah.
And crucially, he is financing it. He has capital tied up in that silo that he could have invested elsewhere to earn interest. Those three elements, storage, insurance, and financing, are called carrying charges.
Okay, so if storage, insurance, and financing cost Fred 10 cents a bushel per month, holding it for 3 months costs 30 cents. Therefore, mathematically, the December futures contract must be trading at $5.30. The distant month is higher to compensate the person storing the physical commodity.
You got it perfectly. In a normal market, the cash price, which is the price today, sits below the futures price. And here is a really beautiful mechanism of the market. The premium of a distant month is capped by something called full carry.
Full carry.
Yeah. If the December contract suddenly shot up to $6, while cash was still $5 and storage was only 30 cents, what would happen?
Well, arbitragers would step in, right? Someone would buy the physical corn today for $5, pay the 30 cents to store it, and instantly sell the December futures contract at $6. They would lock in a completely risk-free profit of 70 cents.
Exactly. And that massive flood of arbitrage selling in the December contract would immediately push the price back down. So a normal market has a mathematical ceiling dictated by the physical cost of storage.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, but that assumes the world is functioning normally. What happens if there is a massive shock to the system? Say, a catastrophic drought wipes out half the country's wheat, or, you know, a war disrupts shipping lanes. Suddenly, Baker Bob's factory is going to shut down tomorrow if he doesn't get wheat today.
That extreme urgency completely flips the market upside down. This creates an inverted market, which the exam also calls backwardation or a discount market.
Aggregation, okay.
In this scenario, Bob does not care at all about the cost of storing wheat for 6 months. He is desperate. There is a severe near-term supply shortage, like a zombie apocalypse for wheat, and people are panicking to get their hands on whatever physical supply is left.
Right. So in an inverted market, the nearby months cost more than the distant months. Bob will gladly pay $10 a bushel today just to keep his bakery alive, even if next year's crop is trading at $5. The cash price spikes up and sits above the futures price.
Precisely. A normal market is driven by the cold, hard math of carrying charges. An inverted market is driven by panic, scarcity, and immediate demand. And here is exam trap alert number two, the direction trap.
Oh, boy.
The exam writers will give you a table of prices for March, May, and July and ask you to identify if it's a normal or inverted market. Or they'll mix up the synonyms, asking you about contango versus backwardation.
Okay, let's break the fourth wall here. Hey, if you're walking your dog right now or doing the dishes, say this out loud with me. If I'm looking at a question and March is $5, May is $5.20, and July is $5.40, the prices are going up as we go further out in time. The distant months are higher. That is a normal market.
Yes.
It's a contango. It's being driven by carrying charges.
Exactly. But if March is $6, May is $5.50, and July is $5, the nearby month is the most expensive. It's sloping downward over time. That is an inverted market. It's backwardation. It's being driven by a near-term shortage.
Yep.
If you can lock the underlying reasons for those price slopes into your brain, you will easily dodge three or four tricky questions on part one.
This naturally leads us to the psychology of the people actually trading these structures. We need to look closer at hedgers versus speculators.
Yes, back to our cast.
Right. We established earlier that Farmer Fred is a hedger, but for the exam, we need to be more specific. He is a short hedger.
Correct. Let's look at Fred's exposure. He is long the cash market, which is just a fancy way of saying he already owns the physical corn. Because he owns it, his great fear is that the price will drop before he can sell it. To protect himself from a price drop, he goes to the futures market and takes the opposite position. He sells futures contracts. Selling futures makes him a short hedger.
And Baker Bob is the exact mirror image. He is a long hedger, or what the exam sometimes calls an anticipatory hedger.
Right.
Bob is short the cash market, meaning he needs wheat to survive, but he doesn't own it yet. His great fear is a price rise. So to lock in his future purchase price, he buys futures contracts.
And then there is speculator Sally. Sally has absolutely no commercial interest in the physical grain. She accepts the price risk that Fred and Bob are desperately trying to shed.
Sure.
Why on earth would she do that? Because she wants the profit. This is a foundational concept. Hedgers use the market to seek price certainty, not profit. Speculators use the market to take on risk in pursuit of profit. In exchange for the chance at profit, speculators provide risk-bearing capital and deep liquidity to the market, allowing Fred and Bob to get in and out easily.
Let's expand on that idea of price certainty for hedgers, because it's a massive insight for the test.
It really is.
Let's say Farmer Fred perfectly hedges his crop. Cash corn is $5, so he sells futures at $5. Suddenly, a terrible drought hits. The price of corn rockets to $7. Fred's short futures position is now losing $2 a bushel. He gets his brokerage statement, and his account is bleeding money. Did his hedge fail?
No, the hedge functioned flawlessly.
Really?
This is where people get so confused. Yes, Fred lost $2 a bushel in his futures account, but because of that same drought, the cash price of the physical corn sitting in his silo also rallied to $7. What he lost on the synthetic futures trade, he gained in the real-world value of his physical crop.
Oh, wow.
A losing futures leg does not mean the hedge failed. It just means the cash market moved in his favor. When you combine the physical gain with the futures loss, he still netted exactly the $5 he originally locked in. The hedge did exactly what it was designed to do. It provided absolute price certainty.
That is such a crucial shift in perspective. You're not trying to win the trade. You're trying to neutralize the risk.
Exactly.
But let's take that drought scenario to an absolute extreme. What happens if the news of the drought hits overnight and it's so catastrophic that the market completely panics at the opening bell? The price of corn tries to go to the moon instantly? Does it just trade at $1,000 a bushel?
No, it doesn't. That introduces the concept of price limits. To prevent absolute chaos and allow the market time to digest massive news shocks, exchanges set daily price limits. A price limit caps exactly how far a futures price is legally allowed to move from the previous day's settlement price.
So let's say the limit for corn is 30 cents. If it settled at $5 yesterday, it cannot trade above $5.30 today. But here is what always confused me. If it hits that limit, does the market just shut down? Like, do the brokers turn off the lights and go home?
No, the market does not close. It locks.
Hey.
Trading is still completely legal and can happen at the limit price or within the limit boundary. But the exchange's computer matching engine will automatically block any trades submitted beyond that limit.
Okay, let's put speculator Sally in this situation because this is her worst nightmare.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Say Sally was short corn at $5, betting the price would go down. The drought hits, the market rockets up 30 cents and locks limit up at 5:30. What is happening to Sally?
Sally is trapped in a burning building. The price has surged against her, so she is losing money and getting margin calls left and right. Naturally, she wants to stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
To exit a short position, she has to buy a contract.
Right.
But the market is locked, limit up. That means every single participant in the market knows the true value of corn is probably much higher, maybe $6 or $7.
Right.
But the exchange legally prevents anyone from bidding higher than 5:30.
So if you are holding long corn, you are absolutely not going to sell it to Sally for 5:30 when you know it's worth more.
Exactly. Why would you? There are thousands of desperate buyers like Sally and absolutely zero sellers. The order book is entirely one-sided, so trading essentially ceases, not because the market is closed, but because no one will take the other side of the trade at that artificially capped price.
Wow.
Sally is trapped in a locked limit-up market, forced to watch her account drain, completely unable to hit the eject button until the limits are expanded the next day.
That is genuinely terrifying, just watching the screen and you can't do anything. Now, before we move on, I want to clarify something. How is a daily price limit for a specific commodity different from a circuit breaker? Because they sound functionally identical to a layman.
They are completely different mechanics, and the exam will test you on the difference. A price limit is a fixed price distance for one specific contract, like 30 cents for corn. A circuit breaker is a coordinated market-wide halt based on a percentage drop in a broad equity index, like the S&P 500.
Oh, okay.
If a circuit breaker hits a specific threshold, say a 7% drop, the entire stock and futures market for equities pauses for a set period, like 15 minutes, and then resumes. It only closes the market for the entire day if it hits the most extreme third tier, which is usually a 20% drop.
So limit locks trap you at a specific price in a specific commodity, while circuit breakers pause the entire casino to let everyone take a breath.
Yes, perfect way to put it.
That makes it easy to remember. Now, if Sally wants to survive in these chaotic markets, she needs to use the right tools. Let's talk about the order book. I want to do a direct comparison of resting orders, because understanding the nuance here is how a trader avoids getting trapped. What is the fundamental difference between a stop order, a stop limit order, and a market if touched order?
Let's start with a standard stop order. Think of a stop order as a defensive panic button. It rests completely out of sight on the exchange servers until the market price hits its specific trigger price. The crucial part is what happens next. Once triggered, a stop order instantly transforms into a market order.
Which means it guarantees you will get filled, but it offers absolutely zero guarantee on the price you will get.
Exactly. If the market is moving incredibly fast, or there is a gap in prices overnight, your stop might trigger at $5, but by the time the market order executes milliseconds later, you might get filled at $4.90. You suffer slippage.
Right.
To conceptualize placement. Buy stops are always placed above the current market price, usually to protect a short position. Sell stops are placed below the market to protect a long position.
Okay, but what if Sally says, I want to get out if it drops, but I absolutely refuse to take a terrible price if the market is crashing? Like, she doesn't want that slippage.
Then she would use a stop limit order. It acts the same initially. It rests until it hits the trigger price. But instead of becoming a market order, it becomes a limit order at a specific price she dictates. This guarantees that she will get her specified price, or a better one.
But there's a massive risk there, right?
A huge risk. If the market is crashing and it gaps straight past her limit price, her order will never execute. She gets no fill at all. She is left holding a losing position while the market completely runs away from her. It's a trade-off between price certainty and execution certainty. You can't have both.
So a stop order is guaranteed exit, unknown price. Stop limit is guaranteed price, unknown exit. What about the market if touch, the MIT?
The MIT is the exact mirror opposite of a stop order. Instead of being a defensive order placed behind the market, it is an offensive order placed ahead of the market. You place a buy MIT below the current price, hoping to catch a quick dip, or you place a sell MIT above the current price, waiting in ambush for a quick rally. The moment the market touches your MIT price, it becomes a market order and fills instantly.
Okay. I've got a direct question for the listener to test order execution rules. Take a second to think about this one. What is the fundamental difference between a fill or kill order, an FOK, and an immediate or cancel order, an IOC?
Take a beat.
Here is the difference. A fill or kill demands that the entire quantity of the order is filled right this second, or the entire thing is canceled. It is all or nothing. An immediate or cancel order allows for partial fills. It takes whatever liquidity it can get right this second and only cancels the leftover unfilled portion.
A great way to visualize it is this. An FOK is like buying parts to build a specific car engine. If you can't get all the parts at once, you don't want any of them because half an engine is useless.
Right.
An IOC is like buying gasoline for your fleet of delivery trucks during a shortage. You will take 500 gallons if they have it, but if they only have 200 gallons, you'll gladly take that right now and they can cancel the rest.
That is a brilliant analogy. Half an engine is useless, so fill or kill it. Now, how does Sally actually decide where to place these orders? She uses market analysis. The exam expects you to clearly differentiate between technical analysis and fundamental analysis.
The divide is pretty straightforward. Technical analysis is looking entirely at the chart and the market data. A pure technician believes that all known fundamental information, you know, weather, wars, earnings, is already instantly priced into the market. Therefore, they only study price action. They look for support lines, resistance lines, chart patterns like head and shoulders, and they track open interest and volume.
Whereas fundamental analysis is looking out the window at reality. A fundamentalist is studying Farmer Fred's crop yield reports from the USDA. They were looking at supply shocks like a global pandemic or an oil embargo. They were studying demand shocks like a recession, and they are analyzing the macroeconomic value of the US dollar.
Right. And while we are on technical analysis, there's a very specific nuanced detail about open interest that the exam loves to test.
Okay.
Open interest is the total number of outstanding contracts that have not yet been offset or delivered. So let's say the price of a commodity is rallying hard. It's going up day after day. But as the price goes up, open interest is actually falling. What does that signal to a technician?
Let me trace the logic. Open interest only drops when existing participants are offsetting and closing their positions. It means P people are leaving the market.
Yeah.
So if the price is going up, but people are leaving, it means the rally isn't being driven by enthusiastic new buyers entering the market. It is being fueled by terrified shorts who are panicking and buying to cover their losing positions.
Exactly. It signals mere short covering. For a technician, this is a massive red flag. A healthy, sustainable bull trend requires rising prices paired with rising open interest, which proves new money is entering to support the move. A rally on falling open interest is brittle and likely to collapse once the trapped shorts finish covering.
That is deep market plumbing right there. While we are looking at fundamentals, we should touch on interest rate futures because the macroeconomic relationship is heavily tested. What happens when the Federal Reserve steps in?
You need to remember the inverse relationship between interest rates and bond prices. If fundamental data shows inflation is running hot, the Fed will tighten interest rates, meaning they raise rates to cool the economy. When rates go up, the price of existing bonds and interest rate futures must fall.
Right.
Therefore, Fed tightening is bearish for rate futures. Conversely, if the economy is weak, the Fed will ease rates, cutting them. When rates fall, the price of interest rate futures rises. Fed easing is bullish.
Rates up, futures down. Rates down, futures up. It's a simple seesaw.
Yep.
Let's keep this momentum and tackle the section that usually causes a fight or flight response for test takers. The math. We have to talk about basis.
I cannot stress this enough.
Yeah.
Basis is the absolute core of all hedging mathematics. If you misunderstand basis, every single hedging calculation you attempt on the exam will fall apart.
So we are going to lock in the formula right now. The golden rule is this. Basis equals cash minus futures. Let me repeat it because it is that important. Basis equals cash minus futures.
That formula is your anchor. Let's connect this back to why hedgers use the market. When Farmer Fred hedges his corn, he isn't actually locking in a completely flat, guaranteed to the penny price for his physical crop. What he is fundamentally doing is swapping a massive, terrifying risk, absolute price risk, for a much smaller, manageable risk, basis risk.
Because the cash price in his local town and the futures price on the Chicago Exchange don't move in perfect lockstep every single day. The relationship between them fluctuates.
Exactly. And that fluctuation, the change in the basis, determines his final financial outcome. Let's do a direct comparison on how basis changes affect our two commercial characters. First, we have a strengthening basis. This means the math of cash minus futures becomes more positive or less negative. For example, if the basis goes from negative 10 cents to negative 5 cents, the cash price is getting stronger relative to the futures price. Who benefits from a strengthening basis?
Let me logic this out. A strengthening basis means the cash value is getting stronger. Farmer Fred is a short hedger. He owns the physical cash corn. Therefore, he wants his cash asset to be as valuable as possible relative to his futures hedge when he finally sells it. So a strengthening basis always helps the short hedger.
Perfect logic. And the exact opposite is a weakening basis. This means the number becomes more negative or less positive. The cash price is getting weaker relative to futures. Say it goes from negative 10 cents to negative 20 cents. Who does this help?
It helps the long hedger, Baker Bob. Bob is short the cash market. He needs to buy physical wheat later. He wants the physical cash price to be as weak and cheap as possible when he finally goes to the local market to buy his supplies. So weakening basis helps the long hedger.
If you can remember that strengthening helps the short hedger and weakening helps the long hedger, you have mastered the conceptual side of basis. But the exam will also force you to do the actual net price calculations.
And this is where I want to push back. Sitting in a timed exam, trying to calculate the gain or loss on the cash leg, then calculating the gain or loss on the futures leg, adding them together, and then subtracting the broker's commission. It is a recipe for a math error. There has to be a more elegant way to solve these net price questions.
There is a massive shortcut. The entire complex net price calculation algebraically collapses into one single simple formula. You absolutely do not need to calculate the cash leg and the futures leg separately.
Thank goodness.
To find the net price realized by a hedger, you just take their initial futures price and add the ending basis.
Wait, really? Just the initial futures price plus the ending basis? Let's walk through why that works because I need to understand the mechanics.
It works because of the formula we anchored earlier.
Mm.
Basis equals cash minus futures. If you rearrange that algebra, cash equals futures plus basis. When a hedger finally unwinds their position, their final realized price is determined by the spread at that exact moment.
All right.
The absolute moves in the cash and futures markets perfectly offset each other, leaving only the discrepancy, the basis. So you simply take the price they originally locked in on the exchange, the initial futures price, and apply the final discrepancy, the ending basis.
That is incredible. So on the exam, they will give me a huge word problem with the opening cash price, the opening basis, the closing cash price, and I can just ignore half of it.
Yes, ignore the opening basis entirely. Ignore the opening cash price. They are distractors designed to waste your time. Find the price they originally executed the futures trade at and add the ending basis. The only other step you have to remember is to apply the broker's commission at the very end.
Okay.
If they are a seller like Farmer Fred, the commission fee lowers their net final price. If they are a buyer like Baker Bob, the commission fee adds to their net final cost.
Initial futures plus ending basis adjust for commission. That is a lifesaver. Okay.
Oh.
Take a breath, because we are moving into a whole new layer of complexity. We need to talk about options and spreading. This is leverage placed on top of leverage.
It is, but if we stick to the core mechanics, it's very manageable. Let's start with options on futures. An option gives you a right, but it does not give you an obligation. There are two types. A call option gives the buyer the right to go long the underlying futures contract at a specific strike price. A put option gives the buyer the right to go short the underlying futures contract.
And to acquire that right, the buyer has to pay a fee, which is called the premium. The premium is the actual price of the option, and it's made up of two distinct components, intrinsic value and time value. Intrinsic value is easy. It is the real tangible money you would make if you exercise the option right this second.
Right.
If you own a call option giving you the right to buy corn at $4, and corn is currently trading in the market at $5, you have $1 of intrinsic value.
Correct. But what if corn is currently trading at $3? Your right to buy it at $4 is currently worthless in real terms. It has zero intrinsic value. It is out of the money. But the option still costs money to buy. Why? Because of time value.
I always think of time value as the price of waiting for a miracle. Even if the option is out of the money today, if there are 3 months left until it expires, there is still time on the clock for a drought or a market shock to swing the price in your favor.
Exactly.
But here is the critical mechanic.
Yeah.
As expiration gets closer and closer, the probability of that miracle happening shrinks, so the time value continually decays. And on the exact day of expiration, time value drops to absolute zero. At expiration, an option is only worth its intrinsic value.
That is exactly how time decay functions. Now, the major exam trap for options revolves around risk and margin requirements. Let's look at the buyer of an option first. For the buyer, their financial risk is strictly and absolutely capped. The absolute worst thing that can happen to a buyer is that the option expires worthless and they lose the premium they paid up front. Because their risk is capped and because they prepaid the premium, the buyer of an option does not have to post futures margin.
But the writer, the person who sold the option and collected that premium, is playing a very different game.
A profoundly dangerous game. The writer, or grantor, collects the premium up front, but in exchange, they take on an open-ended obligation. If they sold a naked call option, their potential loss is theoretically unlimited because the underlying futures price can rally to infinity. Because the writer holds this massive uncapped risk, the clearinghouse demands protection. Therefore, the writer must post performance bond margin. The exam will definitely test you on this.
Mm-hmm.
Before an option is exercised, only the writer posts margin.
The writer holds the bag, so the writer posts the margin. That makes sense. Let's transition to spreading. When I first read about spreads, it sounded like an unnecessary complication. Why buy one contract and sell another at the same time?
You do it to mathematically reduce your risk. A spread is simply taking a long position in one contract and simultaneously taking a short position in a related contract. For example, buying March corn and selling December corn. Why does this lower risk? Because a systemic shock, like a massive global drought, is going to cause all corn prices to spike. If you are long March and short December, the absolute price spike in March makes you money, but it is largely offset by the loss on your short December position. You are immunized against the broad market move.
So as a spreader, you actually don't care at all if the overall market goes to the moon or crashes to zero. You only care about the differential between your two specific legs. You are betting that the gap between March and December will either widen or narrow. Because your absolute risk is drastically reduced, the exchange rewards you by charging a much lower initial margin.
Exactly. You are trading the relationship, not the outright price.
Let's test this logic. I have a direct question for you, listener. If you decide to put on a bull carrying charge spread, which delivery a month do you take the long position in? give it a beat to think through the mechanics of a bull market.
In a bull spread, you are always long the nearby month and short the distant month. And let's explain why. In a bullish scenario, say a sudden shortage, demand spikes immediately. Buyers need the commodity right now. This intense immediate demand pushes the price of the nearby month up much faster and harder than the distant month. It drives the market toward inversion.
Right.
So if you are long the nearby month, its value grows faster than the loss on your short distant month, and the spread narrows in your favor. The rule to memorize is bull spread equals long the nearby. Bear spread equals short the nearby.
Bull equals long nearby. Perfect. Okay, take a deep breath. We are crossing the threshold into the final major hurdle. We are leaving the chaotic trading floor with Fred, Bob, and Sally. We are putting on our suits, grabbing our briefcases, and walking into the courtroom. Welcome to part two, the regulatory gauntlet.
This is the standalone pass or fail gate. You need a 70% on just this regulatory section, where you fail the entire series three, regardless of how well you did on margin math or basis.
Yeah, no pressure.
The tone shifts here because we aren't talking about market mechanics anymore. We are talking about federal law, ethical conduct, and this strict protection of customer money.
Let's meet the regulators who enforce these rules. We have two main players in this space, the CFTC and the NFA. I like to think of the CFTC as the federal feds and the NFA as the club bouncers.
That is a highly accurate way to categorize them. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, is an independent federal government agency. They oversee the entire industry. They register the broad categories of market participants, and they are the ones who investigate massive systemic frauds and manipulation of the Commodity Exchange Act.
It makes stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Then the National Futures Association, the NFA, is the industry's self-regulatory organization. They are the boots on the ground. They grant the actual memberships, they conduct the routine audits of brokerage firms, and they police the day-to-day ethical conduct of the brokers.
And the golden rule is, if you interact with the public in this industry, you must be registered with the CFTC and you must be an approved member of the NFA. Now let's talk about the structure of the firms, specifically regarding who actually gets to hold the customer's money. Because the exam is absolutely obsessed with the money trail, we have FCMs, IBs, and CTAs. Break down the dividing lines.
The absolute dividing line is the money test. An FCM is a futures commission merchant. Think of the massive banks or large clearing brokerage houses. They're the only likely entities legally allowed to accept and hold customer funds, securities, and margin deposits.
Okay.
Because they are the vault holding the public's money. Mm-hmm. The regulators impose strict financial safeguards on them. An FCM must maintain at least $1 million in adjusted net capital at all times.
Okay, so the FCM is the vault. What is an IV? An introducing broker?
An introducing broker is essentially a sales force. They find the clients, they build the relationships, and they might even take the trade orders over the phone.
Right.
But an IB never holds customer money. Never. If a client writes a check to open an account, that check must be made payable directly to the FCM that the IB clears its trades through. Because the IB doesn't hold the funds, they represent less systemic risk, so their capital requirements are much lower. An independent IB only needs $45,000 in minimum capital.
Oh, that's way lower.
Right. There are also guaranteed IBs who borrow the financial and compliance strength of a parent FCM and therefore don't need to maintain their own separate capital.
That makes the distinction very clear. And what about a CTA, a commodity trading advisor?
A CTA is completely removed from the transaction pipeline. They do not hold money, and they do not execute trades. They simply provide trading advice or design trading algorithms for compensation. However, there is a massive exam trap here regarding when a CTA is exempt from registering with the regulators.
I remember this one. A CTA can escape federal registration only if they meet two incredibly strict conditions simultaneously. First, they must advise 15 or fewer people in a rolling 12-month period. Second, they must do absolutely zero public marketing.
Yeah.
If a CTA puts out a single tweet offering futures advice or, you know, hands out a flyer, they must register immediately, even if they only have two clients.
Exactly right. 15 or fewer and zero marketing. If they violate either prong, the exemption vanishes. Now let's talk about what happens when things go wrong. Let's say I open an account and my broker turns out to be a criminal. He churns my account, trading excessively just to generate commission fees for himself, and loses all my money. Where do I go to get my money back?
You actually have a pipeline of choices for dispute resolution, which is unique. You can choose NFA arbitration, you can choose CFTC reparations, or you can go the traditional route and sue them in civil court.
But here's the trap the exam will spring on you. When you open a brokerage account, you sign a mountain of paperwork. Doesn't the brokerage firm just bury a clause in there that forces you into arbitration so they can keep the dispute out of the public court system?
They try, but legally, no, they cannot force you. Brokerage firms cannot mandate a pre-dispute arbitration agreement as a strict condition of opening an account. The customer's agreement to arbitrate must be entirely voluntary.
Okay.
Now, if you do voluntarily sign it, you generally waive your right to sue in civil court. But, and this is a huge protection, even if you sign the arbitration agreement, you still retain the legal right to elect CFTC reparations instead of arbitration, and you can make that choice up to 45 days after the firm notifies you that they intend to arbitrate a dispute.
That is a critical nuance for part two. The customer has immense flexibility in how they pursue a claim. Okay, one final direct question for the listener regarding the regulator's actual power. Let's say the CFTC catches a rogue trader blatantly manipulating the wheat market and stealing millions of dollars. Can the CFTC throw that manipulative trader in federal prison? Give it a beat to think about the jurisdictions.
The answer is no, they cannot.
That is correct, and it surprises a lot of people. The CFTC only has civil authority. They can issue cease and desist orders, they can fine the trader massive crippling amounts of money, and they can seek disgorgement, which means forcing the trader to give all the stolen profits back.
Yeah.
They can ban you from the industry for life, but they do not have criminal prosecutorial authority. If the government wants to put you in a concrete box for a willful felony violation of the Commodity Exchange Act, the CFTC must refer the case to the Department of Justice. Only the DOJ can seek prison time.
The CFTC takes your money and your career. The DOJ takes your freedom. Keep those jurisdictions strictly separate for the exam. All right, we have covered a massive amount of complex plumbing today. We're going to close this out with a rapid-fire recap. This is the brain dump of the highest-yield concepts we just explored. I'll start, you follow.
Let's do it.
Number one, futures margin is a performance bond. It is not a loan, it does not represent ownership, and it charges absolutely zero interest. If you fall below maintenance margin, you must fill the bucket all the way back up to initial margin.
Number two, market structures. A normal market, or contango, means distant months are higher because of carrying charges like storage and insurance. An inverted market, or backwardation, means nearby months are higher because of a severe, panic-driven near-term shortage.
Number three, participant goals. Hedgers, like Farmer Fred, use the market strictly to seek price certainty, not outright profit. Speculators, like Sally, provide liquidity and take on that risk in exchange for the chance at profit.
Number four, the golden rule of math. Basis equals cash price minus futures price. And when calculating the net price of a hedge position, simply take the initial futures price and add the ending basis.
Number five, regulatory jurisdictions. Introducing brokers never hold customer money. They must send it to the FCM. And the CFTC handles civil penalties and fines. They must rely on the DOJ to put criminals in prison.
Excellent. If you can instantly recall the mechanics behind those five pillars, you are going to be in an incredibly strong position when you sit down for the exam.
We want to leave you with one final provocative thought before you get back to your practice exams. We spent a lot of time today talking about how hedging transfers price risk from real-world producers like Farmer Fred to risk-takers like Speculator Sally. This entire ecosystem was built to feed what economists call price discovery, the market's way of finding the true, fair value of a physical commodity based on human supply and demand.
But if you look at the reality of the markets today, the human speculator salaries of the world are increasingly being replaced. The liquidity provision and risk-taking are now dominated by algorithmic trading firms and high-frequency black box algorithms sitting in server farms located microseconds away from the clearinghouse's matching engines.
Right, they are executing thousands of trades in the blink of an eye, reacting to micro fluctuations in data feeds, not to USDA weather reports or fundamental crop yields.
Exactly. So here is the thought experiment to chew on. As these synthetic high-frequency algorithmic bets completely dominate the volume in the order books, are we actually achieving more precise, efficient price discovery for physical goods?
That's a good question.
Or are we slowly creating a hyper-financialized ecosystem where the tail, the massive volume of synthetic millisecond futures bets, is now wagging the dog of the actual physical commodity? When the machines account for 90% of the volume in the clearinghouse, it forces you to think deeply about who or what is actually determining the price of Farmer Fred's corn tomorrow morning.
That is a slightly terrifying evolution of the market, but it proves exactly why understanding the fundamental plumbing of these systems is so incredibly important. You've got this. Keep drilling the concepts, focus relentlessly on the why behind the rules rather than just the definitions, and you are going to crush the Series 3. We'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.